We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Arizona, Colorado, Indiana, Michigan, New Jersey, Tennessee, and Virginia. WynnBET is now live in all these states, and the excitement of Wynn Las Vegas has finally landed in online sports betting and casino play. For boosted parlays to live in-game offs on every major sport, WynnBET gives you the tools to win. Sign up today for your risk-free $1,000 sports bet. Download the WynnBET app now or visit WynnBET.com. That's WHNNBET.com to start winning.
Blue Wire.
Welcome back. This is Big Blue Banter, New York Giants football podcast. I'm Dan Schneier, joined as always by my co-host Nick Pilato. Today, we're lucky to have a special guest joining the show to talk a little Giants football, to talk a little quarterbacks, talk a little analytics, and that's PFF's pro football focus, Seth Felina. I hope I pronounced that right. You can tell me if I didn't after. I'm really bad with pronunciations. He's a senior football analyst at Pro Football Focus, also the co-host of the Too High podcast. And I think one thing that I really like about Seth is when I go to his Twitter page, his pinned tweet is one of the truest statements I've seen on Twitter. That, and he goes, "I categorize everyone I meet in one of two classifications. Either you're an Ant Viv seasons 1 through 3, or you're an Ant Viv seasons 4 through 6. And I can say this, Seth, you strike me as an Ant Viv 1 through 3. I'm an Ant Viv 1 through 3. So is Nick. But having said that, and maybe I'm wrong based on how you looked at me post saying that, but having said that, I struggle with calling Nick an Amphib seasons 1 through 3 because I don't think he has any idea what this reference is, and that alone gives him more status.
Fresh Prince, bro.
All right, fine.
I think I give off on Twitter a 1 through 3 vibe, but really in real life I'm a 4 through 6.
That's wow. Really all right. Fun. Well, at least you're open and honest about it.
One of the worst tweets of all time when you think about it. I appreciate you reading my tweets back to me. Really puts my my life into perspective.
I like the tweet, so I stand by it. How you doing?
I'm good. I'm great. I just got back from Cincinnati, Ohio, the home of PFF. And yeah, doing great.
Excellent, Seth. We're just going to kick this off. So this was Joe Shane's first draft, and I just kind of wanted to get your opinion on how he's doing. You know, the bar was set pretty low by the previous regime. So how do you think Joe Shane's first draft and just how he's doing so far as a general manager? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, when you're picking 5 and 7 and 2 prospects that maybe you didn't think would fall to you. And I think if we were talking, you know, let's say we're talking a year ago after last year's draft and you were like, hey, Kayvon Thibodeau and Evan Neal are gonna be there at 5 and 7 for you. I think people would have laughed at you. I think those two would have been assumed to have been the first and second overall picks in the draft. If we're talking, let's say before last college football season, or honestly, even sometime in the middle of the last college football season. So for them to go and just like have those guys fall in their lap, I mean, there's no. Did you have to do anything for it? No, but at the same time, I think they didn't reach on anybody. I mean, the thing that I've been saying about those two players is when you look at the way they've won in college, you know, they win their reps in college. multiplied by their athleticism, their build, and all that stuff. You're looking at two guys who, if they hit, and obviously the if is doing a lot of work there, if they hit, those are like guys that end up as future, you know, all pro players. So, you know, again, finding those guys at 5 and 7 is as good as you can get, really. Like, I don't think they, I'm sure they're laughing when those two guys kept falling to them. You know, I just at those two picks in the first round. I mean, I have some issues with Wandale Robinson, which maybe we can get into, but like, other than that, it was pretty good. I like Cardell Flatter, like Azudu from UNC. So overall, a good draft. Obviously, you're taking a bunch of players and you're hoping that, you know, the guy, you know, let me see here. Six picks through rounds 4 to 6. And you're hoping that two of them make the roster. But you give yourself a chance by just having all those draft picks.
I actually have a question about Evan Neal. I believe he was your second graded tackle behind Charles Cross. And I just kind of wanted to ask you, you evaluated the draft back in 2020 when Andrew Thomas was coming out. How do you measure Andrew Thomas relative to Evan Neal? And do you think Evan Neal is going to have the struggles that Andrew Thomas had in his rookie season?
Yeah, I think there could be the same type of struggles. I think Neal probably, I mean, you hate to use these words, but like, Neal probably had a higher upside than Andrew Thomas. And I think we all thought that Andrew Thomas was going to hit the ground running probably a little faster than he did. Obviously, that wasn't the case. It's worked out, though. I think the thing with Neal, and like, obviously, we know that offensive linemen in general take longer to become, you know, what we think of them based on their draft position than other positions, especially inside, but even outside too. And I think with Neal, there's just some stuff to fix. It's almost like he grew too fast for his body in a sense, and his balance sometimes is not there. But he's also, you know, he's still, I mean, he's still like almost a teenager, you know what I mean? Like, so like you're like, okay, well, once that fixes itself, and obviously getting good coaching and good, not just coaching on the football side, but obviously good athletic coaching and stuff like that, then I think you're sculpting a really good player, because the power is there, the strength is there, the body mass is there. You're just thinking, you know, I thought when I watched the tape, he was on the ground a little too much, you know, and that to me was a little like a balance thing. He can, you know, get his feet kind of underneath him too much in pass sets. But other than that, I mean, he's as good. I mean, the guy got picked 7th overall, so he's as good as a tackle as you're going to get. I would say, like, let's give him some time. And obviously with Giants fans, you're like, oh, we just saw this. Like, we just saw a guy who we thought couldn't play for a year and then become a real tackle in the league. So, you know, at least he's not going into a situation like Andrew Thomas was, where everyone's going to get on him, get on his ass for a year. I think you would hope that there's a little bit of ease there and let him get his feet wet in the NFL.
I think it's also important to note that Andrew Thomas didn't have the training camp and all of the things that kind of go with that because of COVID-19. And Mark Colombo and Joe Judge were reportedly getting into fights during practices and stuff like that. So it was just a kind of a tumultuous type of situation. But now we have a different head coach here, and that is Brian Daboll. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about his offense, because when Josh Allen came into the league, it seemed like Brian Daboll used a little bit more 12, a little bit more 21 personnel. And then 2020 rolled around, it was a little bit more of 10 personnel, spread the offense out, try to spread the defense out, and there was success early on. But last year, a lot of those two high defenses kind of altered that success and just hindered it a little bit. So I wanted to ask you, how can Daboll mitigate the risk of becoming too one-dimensional with 10 and 11 personnel packages? And do you think some of the Giants' selections in the draft, along with their current personnel, suggest that Daboll may incorporate more 12 personnel than he did over there in Buffalo, maybe to allow him to run the football a little bit more successfully?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one of the more fascinating things, you know, ideas going into the season, is what is the Brian Daboll offense going to look like when he doesn't have Josh Allen as the quarterback? Because I think that, like you said, you know, you know, year one with Josh Allen, they didn't expect Josh Allen to be the starter, and he wasn't the starter until, I don't even remember what happened. There was an injury or whatever. They had the Peterman game and all that stuff. So you have a very different offense. You have more of a multiple thing that they were trying to do. The players weren't good. You know, Josh Allen, when he did end up starting there, was not good. Their starting, their number one receiver was Kelvin Benjamin, who was not good. You obviously saw flashes, but like, you know, we already know the narrative about Josh Allen, which is he just wasn't good in years one and two. And I think as they kept working together, Josh Allen and Brian Daboll, I think there was this idea of saying, like, man, putting this guy in a normal offense is just wasting him. Like, he's too athletic. I think we're kind of realizing now, and we saw it in year one just with his rushing totals, but we're realizing that this guy is like a real athlete. He probably could play a bunch of different positions in the NFL. He's a real athlete playing quarterback. And you're like, hey, you know, what if we made it the more spread you get, the more one-on-ones you're going to get in football, in sports in general. And they said, hey, we actually might have one of the better one-on-one players in this league. So instead of like packing it in and, like you said, going 12 personnel, 21 personnel, all that stuff, screw it. We're 10 personnel, the highest rate in the league, basically, you know, outside of the Cardinals. And then our 11 personnel, we're going to play Dawson Knox, who's like, oh, all right, tight end, but he's more of a slot receiver, to tell you the truth. And even when he's on the field, he is going to play slot receiver. So we're going to be as spread as possible. We're going to create as much one-on-ones as we can. And we're going to put the ball in Josh Allen's hands with, you know, basically one of the highest first down pass rates in the league. And we're just going to let him work it. And, you know, obviously his development in after his second season in that offseason allowed him to be able to work in that offense. But I thought the offense worked for him as well, just as he worked for the offense. He became this, you know, MVP caliber quarterback. You know, he can play under pressure. So and it's not even just like, oh, we're going to be spread, you know, two slot receivers, two wide receivers. I mean, the running back is not staying at the block for the Bills ever. So it's five-man protection. Everyone is one-on-one. And you just say, hey, if we get pressure, no problem, because Josh Allen's going to make a play. Hey, if you know what I mean? Like, hey, if everyone's covered, no problem. Josh Allen's going to make a play with his legs. You know, we can go five-man protection and we can still get the ball down the field because he has the best arm and he can do it while under pressure. Now you look at that, and like you said, they started to have some issues by the back end, at least in the AFC Championship game against the Chiefs in 2020, and then throughout the 2021 season, where Josh Allen was still good, but teams started to treat the Bills first down like it was third down. Because, like, well, why are we putting on our base personnel and we're running vanilla stuff here on first down, thinking we're going to get any type of run game when the Bills are throwing the ball on, you know, 70% of their first down plays, 75%, whatever, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it was like the highest in the league. So they have to make this decision to say, okay, you know what? We're putting too much now on Josh Allen. And if he's off by a bit, we're cooked. So you saw the Steelers game at the beginning of the year, you have the Jaguars game in the middle of the season. Like, we as a coaching staff, to a certain degree, are not doing enough of the heavy lifting for Josh Allen. Now, when he plays just at an average level for Josh Allen, you're scoring 25 points because that's how good he is now. But if he's you know, not as good, you're not getting those games like you're seeing from Jimmy Garoppolo, from Kirk Cousins, from Ryan Tannehill, where the offense can do some of the more heavy lifting for a mid-tier quarterback. Like you said, they saw too many too high coverages. They saw too many blitzes, you know, simulated pressures, creepers, zone dogs, you know, on all the first down stuff, which you just don't see a lot. They had to get out of it. They went to more under center. They brought a fullback on the field, not because they necessarily, like, that's like, oh, we're gonna you know, run the ball for 12 yards a pop. It was like, hey, we need to get the defenses to respect us, our run game and our, you know, formationally a little bit more, so that teams just can't take advantage of the fact that we throw the ball every play and put the ball in Josh Allen's hands every play. And that's kind of, and to me, that's really the evolution of the Bills. And now you talk about going from Josh Allen to Daniel Jones, and it's like, well, guess what? Like, that's not ever going to be the way it plays out. Like, that's just not going to be the way it plays out.
That's where I find it fascinating, too, with the Giants' current personnel having Saquon Barkley, that kind of rare talent, 1 year removed from that injury now. I'm so curious to see how Mike Kafka's influence will kind of step into this coming from the Kansas City Chiefs, and how Saquon Barkley is going to be not just utilized as a passing asset, but also in the rushing attack. I'm wondering if we see more 12 personnel with the Giants, not the Jason Garrett level 12 personnel, but just in what we saw up there in Buffalo because of that Josh Allen effect that you described.
Yeah, I think that's probably, that to me makes sense to me. Obviously, you know, you lose Evan Ingram. You did bring in some interesting tight end pieces, I guess. But like you said, you know, I think they're going to try to play a little bit heavier, try to protect Daniel Jones more, and honestly just try and get him to throw the ball down the field more. To me, that's the biggest thing with Daniel Jones. It's like, when he does throw the ball down the field, when he is aggressive, when he takes chances, when he's under pressure, like, yeah, okay, he's not the best quarterback of all time, but like, you're actually gaining the potential for explosive plays. And you're just not seeing that enough. Like you said, under Jason Garrett was pretty bad. So I just think like getting him to get the ball down the field, and whether that's through play action and kind of forcing him to defined reads down the field, or just calling more deep, you know, deeper concepts. I think that's, to me, that's the way to do it.
I think it's interesting too, Seth, because that may be the way to do it because it fits and it works well with Daniel Jones' skill set. But actually, like, a lot of what you said could happen just from what he did in Buffalo there. A lot of what you said, a higher first down pass rate. That's something I've been calling for years. It could make a big difference for the Giants on offense. More 10 personnel. And it speaks to what they did, in my opinion, drafting Wandale Robinson with Kadarius Toney already on the roster, Sterling Shepard already on the roster, a lot of similar players. And I almost feel like what Dave is going to want to do in the first season, I mean, I remain unconvinced that Dave's and Shane believe Jones is the long-term answer. I think they're treating this 1 year at a time. And so what I think they might want to do in year one is just a lot of layups, make it really easy for Jones, and less so, you know, play action, define reads down the field type stuff. And more so just what we saw in Buffalo, but less of the downfield offense, unfortunately, because, you know, like Greg Cosell said, I think he's certainly right. When he watched Josh Allen's tape, it's like, yeah, there's some great stuff on there, but a lot of it was because Allen was able to hang in that pocket and rip the ball off his back foot and from an unbalanced pace. That's not something Daniel Jones can do. So those opportunities down the field may be way fewer and far in between just because of that fact alone. And so I almost wonder if they're going to have more of just a layup based offense for Jones, where it's just spread out, up tempo, get the ball out of his hand fast, don't make him think too much.
Yeah, the issue is, like, I think there's, like, I certainly subscribe to this to a certain degree, but and I haven't really done so much work on Jones's 2021 season, but thinking about his 2020 season, I'm like, if you're gonna do all these, you know, short throws, you kind of got to be accurate on like 90% of them. And he's like, yeah. Daniel Jones is accurate, but he's accurate on like 75% of them. And it's like, you're not gaining extra yards after catch opportunities. You're obviously not, you know, setting up hopefully manageable, quote unquote, manageable third downs. And I think that would scare me. And I remember, so I did this, looked at when they drafted Kadarius Toney, which I didn't think was a very good pick at the time, like in the first round. And you look at, there's this idea that we have, and again, I think about it all the time. It's like, oh, well, we're going to throw a screen pass. We're going to throw a slant. We're going to throw, you know, a stick route at 6 yards or whatever. We're going to throw a wide receiver screen. And every time Kadarius Toney touches the ball, he's gone. It's over. It's a first down. And it's like the stats just don't back that up. Like when you throw a 6-yard pass, you get 6 yards. And if it's incomplete, then you get 0 yards. Like there's the yak in the NFL. It's just not the same as the yak in college. So that's why I brought it up that the Wandale Robinson pick, where it's like, yeah, he's a good receiver, he's a good player, but I don't know if you're gonna get this returns that you saw in college, where you can give him the jet, you can give him the screen, you can do all that stuff, and it's just assumed that he picks up all this yards after catch. So it's like, and it's like they're good players. This is the issue with Kadarius Toney and Wandale Robinson. Obviously, we're projecting here with Wandale Robinson. We know a little bit about Toney, more off the field, to tell you the truth. But, like, they're good players. But I think if you're picking in round 1, 2, or maybe even 3, at least early in 3, I think you should be looking for more well-rounded receivers. And if one of those guys turns out to be a guy that you can give jets to, that you can give screens to, then so be it. It scares me to take a guy who is catching a lot of those type of plays in college and project it upwards. I'd rather take a guy who is kind of more of a well-rounded player in college and like bring him down if you need to. And when you look at the guys who are running those type of plays successfully, off the top of my head, it's guys that actually are really good receivers. Those guys tend to be the good yak players too. Deebo and Robert Woods and, I don't know, off the top of my head, there's a whole bunch more, but those two for sure. So that's what scares me about saying, okay, we're going to create these quote unquote easy throws for Daniel Jones, where it's like, yeah, you do that for Drew Brees that he did for the last, 8 years of his career, last 6 years of his career. That's fine because he's going to complete all of them and they're going to be, right on the receiver. I just don't know if you're going to get those same returns with this roster and this quarterback. Like I said, that's what scares me. I do agree, throw the ball more on first down, do all that stuff that you can create offense while teams think you're going to run the football. Right. That's always the best way to do it. It does scare me a bit, given Daniel Jones' skill set.
Philip has just lost the respect of the youth league football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this, but Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error, get the Athletic, and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
I'd be scared too. I mean, look, me and Nick have our reservations as well. And especially when it comes to not just the Wandale pick, but this entire offense as it looks right now, at least at the quarterback and skill positions based and how it's going to look for this year. But one thing you did write about last year, I believe it's actually this year, I actually was reading it this morning and I thought it was really interesting stuff. And it was kind of talking about how the NFL's RPO revolution is here. And I think that's something we're definitely going to see a greater emphasis on in Dave's offense than we saw with Jason Garrett. We just given what we saw Jones have success with at Duke, what he had success with under Pat Shurmur, how easy it is for a quarterback. Can you dive a little bit more into the specifics of what you found with RPO usage rates and what exactly your research maybe told you? Maybe some just key takeaways on how the NFL is moving in this regard.
Yeah, I think, like, you know, the thing with RPOs is, like, I've written basically the same article every year for the past, like, 2 or 3 years, basically being like, hey, let's go NFL. Like, it's time. Like, they're college football and high school football has been overrun with RPOs, and now the rules are different from college to the NFL because you have different downfield rules by the offensive line. So in college, I believe it's 4 yards that you have that that leeway. In the NFL, it's 1 yard. But, you know, go through all the RPOs over the past couple of years, and, like, you think any referee is calling a lineman, an NFL lineman, at 3 yards down the field? No, they're not, because they're just like, it's too muddy of a call, and I just think they don't want to call it because they don't want to get into a situation where they're taking away offense. So then I'm like, okay, well, if they're not going to call the actual penalties, then we should just be throwing this stuff all the time. Like, and it just helps, you know, it just helps your quarterback in terms of, and it really goes back to Daniel Jones. And when you think about him with Jason Garrett, you know, the amount of quick game passes, you know, these, like, combinations that involve slants and sticks and speed outs and flat routes and stuff like that. And it's like, those are supposedly easy concepts, but at the end of the day, again, you got to complete them at, like, 90%, or else they're useless to you. Anything on a 90-80%, and it's like, what is the point of us throwing like a 2 yard flat route if there's not a high chance we're gonna, if there's not a 90% chance we're gonna complete it? So look at RPOs and say, well, you're taking that a little bit off the quarterback. You're just making it easier and saying, hey, you got one read here, kind of 2, 1.5, let's say, but you got one read here to throw the football. If not, hey, the easiest thing you can do in the world is hand the ball off to a running back. Yeah. One of the hardest things for a quarterback to do is literally get to his second read. That's like we have, you know, numbers that back this up, like, you know, quarterback completion percentage, you know, PFF grade on a second read throw is just, it plummets from the first read. So, okay, well, what's harder? Throwing to the second read if the slant is not there, or whatever, if the stick route isn't there, or handing the ball off. It's obviously handing the ball off. So we can just help our quarterbacks a lot more. And, you know, the article this, so I think that's the article I wrote last year, and the article I wrote this offseason was more, you know, the idea of the RPO in the NFL is very, it's pretty simple. It's, hey, is there, you know, if I have Devontae Adams, I'm Aaron Rodgers, and I have Devontae Adams, and he's by himself on one side of the field, and the cornerback is off at 8 yards. It's like, well, I take the snap and I throw it to him. That's an RPO, right? That's a run, you know, I have a run play called, and there's no one covering Devontae Adams, or he's too far, and I throw the ball to him. One of the things we saw a little bit more this year, and the Dolphins were a good example of that, was, like, actual downfield RPOs that we see in college all the time, where it's like, hey, we're going to take a slant route, we're going to take a glance route, which is, like, you know, a little bit deeper slant route. You're seeing Pittsburgh, the Steelers run a speed out all the time as a gift throw, as we say. Like, those are the plays where we're getting efficiency from our RPOs. If we're throwing a bubble screen, it goes back to what I said before. We have this idea that every bubble screen we throw to, you know, we throw to even, like, Alvin Kamara is going to go for, even Saquon Barkley is going to go for 100 yards every play, and that's just not the case. So at least with these downfield RPOs, these slants, these speed outs, these glances, even slot fades or whatever, we can actually create offense with this. Like, the ball is going to be caught at 7 yards rather than caught at -2 yards if we decide to pull the ball and throw it. And that's kind of – so that's just my idea of RPOs. Like, I just think every team's got to – like, and I go back to the Dolphins because it was the perfect example. It's like, you have this quarterback who we really still – is still developing. We still don't know – you know, talking about Tua here. We still don't know about his upside. We still don't know who he's going to – you know, quite if he's going to hit those levels. Well, how do we make it a lot easier for him? Like, every time we call a run play and their offensive line is terrible, every time we call a run play, we have a chance to throw a slant for 8 yards. And then Mike Gesicki takes it – or Jalen Wall takes it for a couple extra yards, you know. But at least that helps us with our like kind of mid-tier quarterbacks. And then all quarterbacks, I mean, Patrick Mahomes runs RPOs all the time. So it kind of helps us with all of the quarterbacks.
We've talked a little bit about Daniel Jones, and Dan and I were not certain on if Daniel Jones is the guy per se. So I kind of want to look into the future a little bit. Who is your favorite quarterbacks coming out outside of maybe Bryce Young and CJ Stroud, who we talk about a little bit on this podcast? And who do you think fits Brian Daboll's offense, at least what we saw in Buffalo, the best that the Giant fans should just be paying attention to right now before the college football season?
Yeah, the issue is like who fits the Brian Daboll offense of the past 2 years is one player, right? Like that is kind of the issue. And that is just this freak of a player named Josh Allen. Like we just don't see a lot of these guys, right? Because even like I look at Justin Herbert and I'm like, they're completely different. Their play style is completely different.
Right.
They're both 6 foot, whatever, tall, and they can run around a bit and they have a strong arm, but their play style is completely different. I think, and I haven't gone too deep into his tape, but Tyler Van Dyke from Miami is a guy a lot of people are looking at as this kind of like tall type of player. You know, you mentioned Bryce Young and CJ Stroud, like they're not quite those type of players, but again, it's like, man, is there anyone I don't know if there's really anybody who is like that. Trying to think, you know, I do like Stroud and Bryce Young. And I do think one of the nice things, if you're trying to look into the future here with as a Giants fan, you're thinking, hey, we took these two players 5-7. You know, we have a new coaching staff. We have a new front office. We're trying to, you know, retool here, refigure out the salary cap that was left to us. That was a mess. And we're kind of in this kind of good position with quarterback. If you're treating 2022 as a nothing year, which is a problem, which is no one wants to do that. No one wants to watch their favorite team knowing that we're picking a quarterback next year high in the draft. But that's kind of where we are right now. They're not going to pick up, you know, they've said they're not going to pick up his fifth year option, I believe. And so you're just trying to put together this really good roster for honestly whoever they pick next year. If Daniel Jones plays well, great. You can do whatever you want with that. But if he continues to play at the same level that Daniel Jones has played at for three years, then you're just saying, all right, no problem. Don't pay him. We're probably going to have a top 10 pick then if he plays like that again. And we can go and find one of these quarterbacks like, you know, like Stroud, like Levis, like Levis, like Bryce Young, Tyler Van Dyke, and some of the other players like that.
It's interesting too, because it's like, I feel like the Giants could actually be in position to be in the trade market for a quarterback next offseason, because the cap situation is terrible now, but if you look forward, it's really cleaned out. It's almost entirely cleaned up by next year. And they do have two tackles in place for a quarterback and, you know, some decent weapons at receiver. They don't really have too many holes outside of corner and quarterback right now. And some would say maybe receiver, running back is, there's no one signed, but I'm not worried about running back at all. They'll find that. So it'll be interesting if they're in the trade market for if one of the veterans comes loose. One player I wanted to get your take on, and if you don't have anything on him, it's fine. But have you seen Anthony Richardson at all? Because he, to me, is like an interesting ball of clay type quarterback prospect that I've seen. Some of the throws he makes off balance, just incredible arm talent.
Yeah, like so I haven't rewatched him. So we're putting out our college football preview magazine on July 5th, I believe, and I haven't rewatched him for the magazine, but I did watch him throughout the season when he took over and got some playing time there in Florida. And the issue is just like, Ball Clay is right, because like the arm talent is sickening. He can run the football. You're just like, you're just trying to figure out what he's looking at play to play. But obviously, you know, you're hoping they got a new staff there in Florida. And you're hoping that they can clean up some of those issues. And it looks like he's going to start. I mean, like Emory Jones transferred last week. So you would assume that he won the job in spring, and that caused Emory Jones to transfer. And you're going to get a full season from him in an offense that you would imagine is tailored to him. And hopefully he can develop.
Seth, I want to ask you about the defense. The Giants bring in Wink Martindale, and we've seen the defensive pendulum kind of swing to these two high layered type of looks that Brandon Staley is kind of using with the Chargers, dating back to when he was the defensive coordinator for the Rams. But that's not Wink Martindale's game. Martindale is a middle of the field close defensive coordinator, cover one, need man covering cornerbacks, and they just released their best cornerback in James Bradbury. So how do you envision Martindale's scheme holding up with this thin secondary?
Yeah, you know, you want to say, well, okay, he looks at the roster. We want to say this about every coach, and it's usually not true. We want to say, hey, you look at the roster and you say, hey, you know, I don't have a lot of man coverage guys, so I got to play more zone. I got to do this, and I got to blitz more because of this, and I can play three-man line, I can play four-man line, whatever. And guess what happens all the time? The guy comes in and he plays his defense. So, like, that's probably, you know what I mean? Like, I think if you can figure out a way to kind of come into modernity, I hate to say it like that, but like come into modernity and like run more of the two high stuff and run more zone on early downs and stuff like that, then that would be great. But I just do believe that he'll probably come in and try and teach all this stuff that he was doing in Baltimore for all those years. And you know, the defense is just, it's okay at corner. You know what I mean? Like, it's really just okay at corner. Maybe not even that. So it scares me a little bit. It definitely scares me a little bit going forward with that type of defense, with the characteristics of the team. And like, you know, under Patrick Graham, and at least in 2020, you know, you saw good play out of zone. You know, when they ran zone, playing a lot of cover two, playing a lot of matching routes in cover two and stuff like that. And that was good. And I just don't think you're going to see that again going forward.
I want to talk a little bit more quarterbacks with you, Seth. I thought that it's interesting. To me, it seemed almost like there might have been an overcorrection in this NFL draft at the quarterback position. Just on the surface, I'm curious to get your take. I'm not saying that's the case. We'll see what you have to say about it. But like the idea of like someone with an arm talent like Sam Howell falling to round five. Like, I know Sam Howell has a ton wrong with him. I get it. He's got to work on a lot of things, but you don't find that kind of arm talent typically in round five. And so did you feel like there was an overcorrection at the position, or was this just kind of an indicator of how bad the class was as all these guys fell?
Yeah, I think it's funny. Like, we all looked at these guys in, you know, let's say January or whatever, when we start to do our draft work, and we're like, okay, none of these guys are first round picks. Maybe some of them aren't even second round picks. And then we convinced ourselves, given the history of the NFL over the past, you know, 5 years, 10 years, whatever, that okay, well, even though I don't think they're that type of player, let me just look at all the positives. They all have a certain array of positive aspects, and because I know the NFL is going to take these guys in round one, they're going to take three of them in round one, they're going to take four of them in round one. And then obviously the draft happens, and we find out that no, we should have stuck to our guns here and understood that these guys were just not first round talents. And honestly, I don't even think Kenny Pickett was a first round talent, even though he goes there in the first round. I think I agree with you. The Sam Howell thing to me is the wildest one, because I don't think, again, the first round talent, probably not, but the arm talent is probably too good to fall all the way to where he fell. I mean, to tell you the truth, even Malik Willis, I have some massive issues with Malik Willis in terms of him actually like playing quarterback, but like, arm talent seemed to be too good to fall as far as he did. And then I think about it, like, you know, one of the things that I've been thinking about this for a little bit, is one of the things that we're not privy to is really like who these people are in terms of their personalities. And talking to some people who know Justin Herbert, they're like, he's a savant. Like, he's like photographic memory. He just gets it. He just, you know what I mean? Like, one of those type of guys. Now, why it didn't work out as well as it should have in Oregon, if he's like that, I don't know. But the Chargers, so we all in draft, you know, draft Twitter said, well, he's whatever quarterback. I famously said some words about him that I regret. But the point is that The point is that he goes into the offices. He works with the GM, the OC at the time, the quarterback coach at the time. They're drawing stuff up on the board. He's trying to like learn it all for the first time, and then repeat that information, and then do it on the field. And you know, blind, they're gonna put a blindfold on him. They're gonna tie his right hand behind his back, and like that type of stuff we're not privy to. And then when you see Justin Herbert play, especially even as a rookie, you're like, oh, okay, he's a savant. Like, he just gets it.
Yeah.
And I think that type of thing, and again, like, I don't have any information on the two guys that I mentioned, like Malik Willis and Sam Howell, but it's almost like, to me, that is what swings them from, let's say we have second-round grades on these guys, that's what swings them from maybe late first-round picks to where they ended up getting picked third, fourth round, stuff like that. So those are, for me, the things that I've been thinking about a lot, and like, how do you handle pressure? How do you handle anxiety on the field and stuff like that? So I to me, that tells me something about them. And again, like, I'm talking out of my ass. I don't know those two particular cases, but it when I see guys fall like that, it tells me something. It really tells me something about who they are.
I think it's a really interesting point too, because, you know, a lot of the times people are like, oh, Daniel Jones went to Duke, he must be a smart quarterback. Well, there's a difference between going to Duke and Justin Herbert going to Oregon and being a biomed major and having that ability to have that kind of photographic memory that he has. And that's one of the most underrated aspects. Everybody looks at Herbert, they see all these big time throws and the ability to stick throws in tight windows. And it's like, wow. But you don't realize how good he is at processing. And you said it best earlier in this podcast. I think this is the number one takeaway for quarterback. How good are they at getting to the second read and then making something out of that second read? That's all it is right now, it seems like, to me in the NFL. The quarterbacks who are good versus the quarterbacks who are bad, for the most part, that's it. Or occasionally, you know, you have some quarterbacks who do it a little differently. Obviously, Josh Allen is a different case. But it's interesting to me, just looking at this class, how it feels like the NFL maybe saw it as, well, none of these quarterbacks are really that good at getting to the second read, so let's not even invest anything crazy in them.
Yeah, that's, you know, it's funny. I was just looking up the Daniel Jones High School, because I feel like that would tell me something. And the tuition for the high school, I went to public school, it didn't cost me that much. tuition for the high school is between $18,000 and $25,000. So yeah, this whole Duke versus Oregon thing versus whatever, it's really like, okay, well, you were like a biomed, like you said, a biomed major. That tells you something more than just going to Duke, I think, when your high school costs that much money. So we have to get to that though. But yeah, that's, I you know what, I'm going to bore your listeners here, but like, I played flag football for a long time now, and I didn't play quarterback in high school, but I started playing quarterback. I coached quarterback for a long time at the college level here. And, you know, I started playing quarterback and flag, and I'm looking up and I look at myself and I'm like, you know, coach football, I do this for a living. I know all the schemes. I know all the routes. I know all the reads, and I'm fucking terrible. I am fucking terrible. And it's like, yeah, you know why? Because like my brain, like I get anxious, you know what I mean? The rush is coming. I get anxious. I don't set my feet properly. I do it in practice. No problem. You know what I mean? Pre-game, whatever. No problem. The second anything happens, like there's this pressure, and I don't mean like necessarily like what we call pressure in the NFL, where a defender is within, you know, 3 feet of you or whatever we call a pressure. I mean like a literal pressure from being, you know, an athlete being on the field and stuff like that. And we don't have we're assuming that if the player is good in college, that they have found a way to deal with this inherent anxiety, but there's no guarantee. And obviously when you're a super athlete playing against worse athletes, then the anxiety, those issues don't come to the forefront until you're playing at a level playing field, which you are in the NFL for the most part. So yeah, that those are just some of the things that we don't know. The teams get a better idea of it as they actually talk to the players and give them personality tests and give them other stuff like that, you know, more better than the stupid one they give to at the combine, the Wonderlic, you know what I mean? So just stuff like that we're not privy to, but I think it's super important for, and especially for the quarterback position that takes so much more, you know, ideas and thinking and stuff like that to play it at the high level.
Yeah, I've heard former Vikings general manager Rick Spielman talk about the tests
that they outsourced to a company that they gave to quarterbacks that they were thinking about drafting that really tested their reactionary quickness under heavy pressure, and how that was a lot different from a lot of the other intelligent type of tests like Wunderlich and things like that. But Seth, I wanted to ask you about something that I've seen you write about and I heard you speak about, and it's Dak Prescott and his ability to create offense within the structure of Kellen Moore's system. And you've mentioned almost like Dallas doesn't do enough to simplify things for Prescott, which isn't necessarily a slight on him, but I just wanted to kind of ask you, what was it about Dallas's 2021 offense that just lacked an identity?
Yeah, I mean, it's I don't know if it lacked an identity. I think they tried to do a lot of stuff, and they tried to drop back and throw the football. And every time you drop back and throw the football without play action, especially, you know, we've talked about it a bit, the way defense is heading, where they're putting a lot more guys into coverage, being able to disguise more and stuff like that, I mean, you're going to end up getting your quarterback to his second read, unfortunately, going back to what we were talking about. Now, I think Dak is a good enough player where, for the most part, he's able to deal with this. But is Dak Tom Brady? Like, no, he's not. I think he's probably in I know it's a Giants podcast, and you guys are going to like me, but like, he's probably in like tier 2.5, right? I don't know if he's tier 2, but he's close enough there that I'm willing to make the bet on somewhere between tier 2 and 3 of the quarterbacks. So he makes it work because he's so good. And the offense isn't bad. I don't want to say here that the offense is bad. It's just, it puts a lot of strain on the quarterback position in the same way we were talking about with Josh Allen, but without the, I would say probably without the ability to hit the explosive plays, because that's just not who Dak is compared to Josh Allen. So that was my concern. Like, when if you're Drew Brees in his prime, if you're Tom Brady, if you're Peyton Manning in his prime, if you're, you know, Mahomes or whatever, you just don't have bad games. You're just like there all the time. So you don't really need, you could just drop back and throw the football. You know, with Dak being, like I said, not in that tier one group, it's like you're going to have games where you're going to have to do it for him. Like, you're going to have to create open receivers specifically down the field so you can create explosive plays. And it's like, you know, I watch it a lot and I'm like, I see Dak, you know, I use this example all the time where it's like Dak will hit Amari Cooper. I'm not there anymore, but he'll hit like Amari Cooper on like a 5-yard in route as his like fourth progression. And you're like, oh, that's great quarterback play. Guess what? They get 6 yards. Like, there's no point. Like, what is the fucking point of this, right? Like, let's create offense down the field. That's how we can move the football. So that is kind of – those were kind of my issues with Kellen Moore. It's like the offense made sense, I think, schematically. I had issues with what they did in the playoff game there that they lost to San Francisco. But the offense made sense schematically. It just puts so much pressure on Dak. And if he's not, you know, playing at that elite level – which obviously we know he has games where he doesn't, it's going to look pretty bad.
Yeah. I want to get you – we want to be cognizant of your time, so I want to get you out of here. But I want one more question with you, Seth, because you really know a lot about quarterbacks, and I think this is really important for Giants fans. So one thing I always hear from Giants fans, and I want to hear your take on this, is this whole idea of we can't really evaluate Daniel Jones through the first 3 years because this wasn't there for him, right? His offensive line wasn't there for him, his receivers, his coordinator, everything just wasn't working for him. And a lot of the time, I think some people really honestly feel like, just from reading some of our fans and listening to some of our fans, that every single play was a breakdown from the offensive line. And yeah, sure, there are some clips out there. But when you actually watch the tape, like me and Nick do, there are plenty of examples of the offensive line not even really being a factor in the play at all. It's just Jones locking onto that first read. It's not there. It's not there. He thought it was going to be there pre-snap. It's not. And he just doesn't know what to do. And by the time he gets to the second read, yeah, then the offensive line may be breaking down. But it's way too late at that point. And so one thing that scared me a bit about Jones is, actually, you mentioned how the accuracy hasn't been like 80-90% in those short area. But actually, according to Pro Football Focus, I believe this was from last year, he actually ranked in the 5 to 10 yard range as one of the 5 worst, least accurate quarterbacks, right? Either above or below Sam Darnold. And that's what PFF had. So the accuracy has actually gone way down. And that shows up on tape too since his rookie season. I want to first ask you, how much can you take away from a quarterback who has nothing working for him from an offensive line coordinator and skilled player standpoint and injury standpoint? But also, what are some ways that fans can look to separate quarterback play from a supporting cast? I think that's the real one I want to take away for the fans. Like, as they're watching the games, how can they separate the quarterback play from the cast?
Yeah, I don't know if you could do it on the broadcast view because you don't see anything, right? You know, the ball is snapped, and then you get to zoom in on the quarterback. So it's like, yeah, you can look into his eyes, but you can't actually see anything that's going on down the field, which is like the whole point of this position. So that's tough. Obviously, you know, I'm telling you, hey, go get a Game Pass, end of a Game Pass subscription, and try not to kill yourself, and then.
Product this year. It's about time.
Yeah. I luckily I don't have to deal with that anymore. I'm data privileges, but so you know, do that and just be like, hey, there's people open here. That's the main thing. Is like there's people open on plays within the time frame of, you know, when the guy is supposed to be open and not supposed to be open, and like. Okay, is Jason Garrett like the greatest offensive coordinator of all time? No, but he's been in the league for a long time. The play calling is like the play designs, they're not can like take draw him out of his ass. You know what I mean? Like they exist in the history of football. They're not peewee plays. So yeah, it's just like at the end of the day, like the quarterback is the one who's going to elevate everything if he can play. And I think we're at this point here where obviously they're going to give him one more chance here, but it doesn't look like he's done that throughout his career. You know, I look at Herbert. I mean, going back to Herbert, like they brought in Joe Lombardi in his second year. Like in Herbert's second year, they're bringing Joe Lombardi from the Saints. When Joe Lombardi was an OC in Detroit in like 2012 or something, 2013 or something like that. Like
it was terrible.
Terrible, right? Like he was absolutely terrible. With clearly a pretty good quarterback in Matt Stafford,
who's right?
Done, you know, he's still starting at age 32 or whatever. So who knows if Joe Lombardi is any good? But you put him with a quarterback who can elevate the whole thing in Herbert, and it looks amazing, right? So like. At the end of the day, it's quarterback. We're not talking about a guard. We're not talking about a running back. We're talking about a quarterback here who has the ball in his hands on every play, who is the passer, right? He is the one making all these decisions. And I think we can clearly see that it just hasn't been to the level, and especially getting picked sixth overall, it just hasn't been to that level, regardless of talent surrounding him.
Fair enough. Seth, thank you so much for taking the time today to join us. Seth, why don't you tell the listeners one more time where they can find you on Twitter, and then what kind of and where they can find your podcast?
You can't find the podcast anymore because my good friend Deontay Lee left me high and dry for another job.
That's
disappointing. Yeah, it's very disappointing. But I'll be back with some more content, whether it's on podcast, whether it's on podcast or YouTube or something like that, soon. And then you can find me on Twitter, PFF_Seth. Come check me out. I got a lot of tweets about Cincinnati's skyline chili, and that's about it.
He did have a lot of skyline chili tweets. Apparently, he tried to smuggle it through the border. I've never had skyline chili, but I got to be honest with you. On glance and from what I've seen online, it looks absolutely disgusting. I'm just going to be completely honest with you, Seth. So maybe I'm just dead wrong on that.
It's not better than it looks.
Sad. Oh, it's not about the taste. You just like it.
I like the idea of it. I got a little bit of time here. Let's talk about this thing that I'm really interested in without actually doing any research. But like most big cities, let's say, have this idea of like a cultural food icon staple that probably comes about because lower socioeconomic group are trying to put stuff together. There's not a lot of money in the Great Depression, blah, blah, blah. So like here where I'm from, we have the poutine, right? It's cheese, gravy, and fries. It's nothing.
It's excellent.
But it's like, it's excellent, right? You have literally in New Orleans, you have the po' boy, which I'm pretty sure is poor boy. Just like a way to get food together when you don't have any money. And I think Cincinnati is, the skyline chili is pretty much just that. It just hasn't been able to be elevated. Though the po' boy can be elevated, the poutine can be elevated, the New York hot dog can be elevated, the pizza can be elevated, this guy on chili, sadly, cannot be elevated.
That's awesome. We'll end it on that. Thank you to everybody tuning in. Have a great rest of your week, and we'll talk to you soon.